Welcome to Ekatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Okay, let's unpack this and dive into a novel that really defines an entire era. Ernest Hemingway's first major novel, The Sun Also Rises, published back in 1926. For you, the listener, this is a deep dive, not just into the story, but into, well, the very DNA of the modern literary voice.
Right. Hemingway. When we talk about him, we're talking about a giant Nobel laureate.
Yeah.
And the guy who basically perfected the iceberg theory. You know, the idea that most of the stories wait, the real emotional
those
stuff.
Underneath the surface, unsaid.
Exactly. 7/8, he suggested, lies beneath. Our mission today is to really explore how this defining work captures the feeling, the essence of the lost generation.
Yeah, that term lost generation is absolutely key here. And the novel, it doesn't waste any time setting up the stakes for these people. Who were they really, and why were they so lost?
Well, they were primarily that group of young people, Americans, Brits, living as expatriates in Europe. They came of age just as World War I hit.
Mm-hmm. The Great War, the industrialized slaughter.
Precisely. And they found that all the old certainties, things like chivalry, patriotism, even faith, they felt completely hollow after seeing that kind of carnage. It just rendered everything meaningless. So they were left disillusioned, spiritually adrift, kind of numb, really.
And Hemingway frames this internal struggle brilliantly right from the start with those two epigraphs. It sets up this core tension that kind of pulses through the whole book. It really does. The first one is that famous quote from Gertrude Stein, "You are all a lost generation." That hits you immediately. That's the human condition we see right away. The chaos, the constant drinking, the aimlessness, the day-to-day reality for them.
Yeah. But then Hemingway puts it next to the quote from Ecclesiastes, "The sun also ariseth and the sun goeth down." That's the bigger picture, the cosmic view. It throws the short, messy, tragic lives of these characters against these huge, eternal, indifferent cycles of nature. Indifferent is the word.
It really is. And it makes you ask, you know, does life have any meaning if the universe just doesn't care? If the only constant is that indifferent, that contrast, human fragility versus this vast, enduring backdrop, it's really powerful. Now, getting into the story itself, our sources mention it functions a lot like a Romana Clef.
Mm-hmm. Fiction, but based heavily on real people and real events.
Specifically, that 1925 trip to Pamplona for the Festival of San Fermin.
Yeah, and that gives it this raw, almost documentary feel, doesn't it? The basic premise follows this small group of expats, Americans, and Brits, just sort of drifting through life in 1920s Paris, mostly.
A kind of hollow existence.
Completely hollow. It's just one party after another, endless cafes, bars. And the drinking, it's almost constant. But it's clearly not about pleasure. It feels more like an anesthetic, a way to numb this shared pain they all carry.
And at the center of that pain, almost the physical symbol of their generation's brokenness, is our narrator, Jake Barnes.
Jake. Right. He's this American journalist, a war veteran, quite stoic on the surface. But the novel's core conflict really hinges on his war injury. It's unnamed, but it leaves him impotent.
And that's not just a plot device, is it? It's doing heavy symbolic work.
Oh, absolutely. It's probably the most powerful symbol in the book. It stands for the emotional, the psychological sterility, the impotence, really, of that entire generation. They're fundamentally damaged, unable to connect properly, unable to create lasting happiness.
And because of that specific physical damage, the central romance is just doomed from the start. This impossible love between Jake and Lady Brett Ashley.
Brett. Yeah, she's magnetic, chaotic. She's the emotional engine of the whole thing. The text makes it pretty clear she genuinely cares for Jake, maybe more authentically than anyone else.
But it can never be physically realized.
Exactly. Which makes the love perpetual, but also agonizing. It's this constant unresolved tension, love trapped by trauma, by circumstance, and it just drives them and everyone around them into these destructive patterns.
So thinking bigger picture, the novel isn't really about a straightforward plot, is it? It's more about watching how these different characters try to cope or fail to cope with this brokenness. Let's dig into this ensemble. What about Jake's approach? What's his code?
Well, Jake, despite everything, he tries to be the moral center, or at least find one. His whole journey is about endurance. He's searching almost desperately for some kind of functional code to live by now that the old ones are gone.
So what does that look like for him?
It looks like stoicism. Honesty about his limitations, trying to suffer with some dignity. By the end, he doesn't find happiness. Not really. But he achieves this kind of weary, hard-won resignation and acceptance of how things are.
But hold on, if he's the moral center, how do we square that with him later helping Brett have an affair with Pedro Romero, the man he loves?
That's the complexity, isn't it? That's where the stoicism becomes almost a tragic flaw. You could argue he does it out of this deep, maybe even masochistic kind of love. He sacrifices his own feelings to give Brett what she wants in that moment, even knowing it'll hurt him.
Because he can't fulfill her desires himself.
Right. His code, in a twisted way, maybe demands he facilitate it because of his own physical inability. It's a really bitter, tragic kind of self-control, or maybe even enabling. It definitely complicates him.
It really does. Okay, then there's Lady Brett Ashley. You called her magnetic, chaotic. She's often seen as this iconic new woman of the 1920s. She is. Independent, sexually liberated, travels freely, but she's also deeply broken. Haunted by a love lost during the war. Her freedom often feels more like a restless cage. She keeps repeating this pattern. Reckless behavior, a flash of regret, then right back into the cycle. A circular path.
Exactly. She can't commit, can't find peace. That's her wound, the spiritual equivalent to Jake's physical one. A fascinating, but yeah, ultimately destructive figure.
And contrasting sharply with both of them is Robert Cohn. He seems to be the one everyone else in the group loves to hate. Why is that?
Cohn is the crucial foil, the outsider. And the key thing is, he's the only major American character who didn't fight in the war. So he still clings to these, well, outdated romantic ideals, chivalry, the kind of stuff you'd read in old novels.
And the others, the war veterans, they just see that as naive, pathetic even.
Completely. They see his idealism as totally out of touch with the harsh, cynical reality they now inhabit. He keeps trying to force this romantic narrative onto Brett, onto their lives, and it just doesn't fit. It clashes horribly with the post-war world.
And his inability to let go of those ideals to adapt leads to his downfall within the group.
Total alienation, yeah. The others have learned, maybe the hard way, that cynicism is almost a survival tool. Cohn hasn't learned that lesson. He wants to be the romantic hero, but he just ends up looking foolish, getting beaten up. It shows how irrelevant those old ideals have become.
Yeah.
Okay, and then there's the figure who stands apart from all this dysfunction. Pedro Romero. The young bullfighter, Romero, yes. He's only 19, but he represents everything the Lost Generation characters are not.
Yeah.
He has discipline. He's connected to this ancient tradition, this ritual. He embodies what Hemingway famously called grace under pressure.
In the bull ring.
In the ring, facing death with courage, with artistry. He represents a kind of authentic masculinity, a potent connection to life and its risks. He's like a fixed point of honor, and you measure the moral drift of the expats against him.
So let's walk through the plot, which feels very episodic. Moving from Paris, then Spain.
Right.
It sort of mirrors their own aimless searching.
It does. Book one is really the Parisian prelude, setting the scene, establishing that rhythm of aimlessness, the constant drinking, the tangled web of desires and jealousies, Kuhn's obsession with Brett, which started after their brief affair.
In San Sebastian, right?
Right, in San Sebastian. That obsession starts poisoning the group dynamic. Lots of tension, unspoken pain. And the dialogue is so clipped, emotions are held way down. Classic Hemingway iceberg. Then we get that really important interlude. Jake and his friend Bill Gorton go fishing up in Burgett in the Spanish mountains. It feels like a total shift in tone. It's crucial. It's the counterpoint to Paris. Like a temporary cleansing, a baptism almost, a moment of peace, of purity, simple, real pleasures, nature, the cold river, good cheap wine, genuine companionship.
Away from the corruption and the posing of the city.
Exactly. It's this brief glimpse that maybe meaning is possible, but only when life is stripped down to these simple, honest rituals. But it's a clarity they just can't hold on to.
No, because that peace gets completely shattered when the whole group converges on Pamplona for the Fiesta of San Fermín. This is where everything just explodes.
Yeah, the Fiesta acts like a pressure cooker.
Yeah.
The chaos of the running of the bulls, the relentless drinking, it just cranks up all the hostility that's been simmering under the surface. Mike Campbell, Brett's fiance, who's drunk and basically bankrupt.
He gets particularly nasty towards Cohn.
Viciously so.
Yeah.
Constant anti-Semitic taunts. And the tension skyrockets when Brett becomes fixated on Romero. She's drawn to his authenticity, his purity, maybe.
And this is where Jake makes that difficult choice we talked about. His tragic complicity. He actually helps Brett start the affair with Romero.
He does. It feels like this final desperate act of service to her, even though it betrays himself, betrays his friendship with Cohn in a way. And that act triggers the physical violence.
Cohn finally snaps.
Driven by his wounded pride and those failed romantic ideals, he tries to assert himself physically. He beats up Jake, he beats up Mike, and then he confronts Romero.
But Romero's reaction is key, isn't it?
Absolutely. Even though Cohn is bigger and stronger and beats him badly, Romero refuses to be intimidated. He maintains his dignity, stays true to his code, even while physically hurt. He doesn't back down. It's a powerful contrast.
And the fallout from that violence is immediate. The group just fractures completely.
Totally implodes. Friendships destroyed. They've hit rock bottom, morally and personally. Everyone leaves Pamplona in disgrace.
Jake retreats to San Sebastian to recover. But there's one last twist, right? Brett sends him a telegram from Madrid.
Yeah. She needs him. She's left Romero.
And the reason she leaves him is significant. She realizes she'd ruin him. Her lifestyle, her corruption would destroy his purity, his career.
It's arguably her one moment of real grace, a genuine act of self-sacrifice. For once, she steps outside her destructive cycle because she recognizes she'd taint the one authentic thing she's found. She protects Romero's integrity, even at the cost of her own desires.
And Jake, ever loyal, ever bound by his impossible love, goes to her in Madrid. Which brings us to that famous final scene. And lets us think about the bigger themes. How does one live with dignity in this broken world?
Well, the novel keeps contrasting the aimlessness of the expats with the ritual and code of bullfighting, the efficient.
Let's clarify efficient. It's not just being a fan, is it?
No, it's much deeper than that. It's a real passion built on knowledge, respect for the tradition, this almost spiritual commitment to the ritual, to the art of facing mortality with honor. It's a whole philosophy of living, really.
A framework for dignity that the expats just can't seem to grasp.
Exactly. They're too paralyzed by their trauma, by their irony. They can't access that kind of commitment.
And this ties back to Hemingway's style, the iceberg theory. All that pain is just under the surface. How does he show it without stating it?
Through omission, mainly. The prose is so spare, so simple on the surface. You never hear Jake explicitly complaining about his injury or raging about the war. Instead, you read things like, I ordered another bottle of wine. Then maybe I ordered a third.
The drinking becomes the commentary.
It's the narrative anesthetic. The misery is in what's not being said. The weight is in the clip dialogue, the repetition, the endless ordering of drinks. The very simplicity of the language mirrors their emotional avoidance, their inability to articulate the depth of their despair.
The novel also digs deep into masculinity, doesn't it? Jake sort of redefines it through his stoicism, his inner code, while Kuhn's romantic version fails spectacularly.
Yeah, it's like a search for a new modern definition of manhood after the war blew up all the old ones. Kuhn needs that external validation and wants to be the hero. Jake seeks internal validation through self-control, through enduring. Quite radical for the time, suggesting character, not just physical capability, defines a man.
Which circles us back to that final devastating scene in the taxi in Madrid. That one exchange that just says everything. Brett gets close to Jake. She's maybe a little drunk, definitely wistful. And she says that heartbreaking line, oh, Jake, we could have had such a damn good time together. It's the beautiful dream, isn't it? The life they can imagine but never, ever have. And Jake's reply, it's the final word. Cynical, yes, but also just utterly resigned to the truth. He acknowledges her fantasy, the prettiness of the thought, but he immediately punctures any illusion that it could ever be real. He just says, yes, isn't it pretty to think so?
Mm.
Wow, just gutting.
It's the final acceptance. They're trapped. The ideal is lovely, but reality is unchangeable. The sun will rise tomorrow, sure, but their personal tragedy is fixed.
Right.
There's no escape.
So ultimately, the sun also rises seems to suggest that real strength isn't about denying loss or pretending things are different. It's about finding a way to accept reality, even the harsh parts, with some kind of dignity, enduring the unendurable.
I think that's right. And its lasting power, especially for you digging into these sources, lies in seeing that universal struggle. How do you build a personal code, find resilience, when the world itself doesn't seem to offer any inherent meaning? Which leaves us with something to chew on. If Jake's code requires such stoicism, such honesty about his wounds, what's the cost of that? Does that very resignation end up trapping him just as much as Brett's recklessness traps her? Is there a point where stoicism becomes its own kind of prison?
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.